It's hard to imagine life in Wisconsin without access to our wonderful natural areas and the wildlife that inhabits them. There are serious threats that emerge, and then we really rely on some solid research and effective leadership to address those concerns. Larry Mueller here. Really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, who comes by the first Wednesday of every month to share what he's been seeing and to help you and I understand what's going on out there. And Scott, great to see you once again.
Well, it's good to be back. I wish I could say, gee, it sure looks like spring out there, but it I'm afraid it doesn't.
I'm afraid it doesn't either. And I want to get, we'll talk about that, but one thing that's been on my mind is this new report on chronic wasting disease here in Wisconsin. I think, and I have not addressed that on the show, you and I haven't talked about it. What are the findings of that report?
Well, I think the most germane information right now are the test data, which have been released for the previous series of hunting seasons from 2013 into early 14. And I think with deer, the lion's share of the publicity over the last year or two has been with the so-called Deer Trustees Report or Deer Czars Report, which led to the acceptance of virtually all of the recommendations that Dr. Kroll and his team made by the Natural Resources Board a month or so ago. So people have been preoccupied with new zones and lack of on-site registration and all the other changes that we'll be seeing over the next couple of years. And CWD, which Kroll recommended a more passive approach to, whatever that meant exactly, it kind of took the back seat for a while, but I think that may change with the release of the test data, wherein the DNR, and by the way, there was a nice summary of this. If people want to see all the numbers, they can find it on the DNR website under the CWD section, but it was also very nice. There's been a couple of articles by Pat Durkin and others who have summarized all this. So the upshot of the whole thing is that the DNR verified a record 350 CWD positive deer for this last collection period, which actually ends at the end of the month. That's with fewer deer tested. So they collected to achieve those 350 positives, they collected and tested 4,319 samples, which was 9% fewer than 2012 and 11% fewer than in 2011, yet more positives.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to be a math major to conclude that means the incidence rate or the infection rate, if you want to think of it that way, has gone up, and it has. So that's a disturbing finding. So not only are more deer affected by the disease in areas where we knew the disease was in place, but there have also been some positive discovered in newer areas on the fringe of what we felt was the affected area. And in what's been described the core area, just west of Madison here, and sadly enough, centered directly on the farm that I've hunted on for 40-some years. So for that core area west of Madison, western Dane and most of Iowa County, for the 2013 hunting seasons or the recent testing period, talking about older bucks, the deer that most hunters would say, that's what I'm after, a 2.5-year-old or older buck. Well, the rate of positives for the disease in that cohort is almost a full quarter now, 24%. One in four, essentially, of adult bucks. And that's up from 8% in 2002 when the disease was discovered, and up from 22.5% the year previous. So, you know, the numbers are scary enough, but I think it's the trend that is probably most disturbing if somebody really sits down and gives it some hard thought.
Where do we go to try and stop or at least slow it down?
Well, that's a good question. If the notion of this passive approach that Kroll called for is maintained, and that's basically just monitoring, you know, where is this kind of data? Where is it? How prevalent is it? Are there any new areas? So we know the situation, but we're really not doing anything about it. And the question, of course, that the $64 million question is, well, what would we do or should we do? The other report that caused a little consternation a few weeks ago was Illinois' release of their data suggesting that with a much more aggressive program, not passive, but aggressive, using state sharpshooters and marksmen and a concerted effort at herd reduction where they knew there were positive deer, they claim they've stabilized the percentage of deer affected. I don't believe that that's directly applicable to Wisconsin because there are some differences in land use, cover type, number of hunters, hunting tradition, the way the deer are distributed in pockets and woodlots in Illinois. So whether that has any bearing or not, the reality is, if you mention that, of course, we did use sharpshooters back in the early days of CWD discovery, and that was so unpopular with hunters and landowners that it was eventually discontinued. And I'm not sure that the public hunter or political support is there to implement anything like that again. And frankly, I'm not sure that the folks involved could tell us with any degree of certainty that that would be the answer or anything else. And unfortunately, while we proceed with this monitoring, we're seeing things kind of go to heck in a handbasket here. And
you're going to reach a point where there's no turning back on this. I mean, maybe we may have already reached
that tipping point. But the point that I think is going to come up beforehand is that some hunters, myself included, you know, as you know, that the deer that my son shot tested positive. It was because I couldn't hunt with the surgical complications. It was the only deer we had. And, you know, I had to dig it out of the freezer and throw it away. That's very disconcerting, and it's happened to us enough now, us being my hunting group on this farm, where I think we're up to 16 or 17 positives on that one farm since 2002. You know, eventually you come down to thinking, wow, you know, I still enjoy the experience, but the odds are becoming so skewed that, gee, there's a pretty good chance that the deer you shoot is going to test positive and have to be thrown away. You know, you start to think, well, maybe I should head up to our place in northern Wisconsin, or maybe I should find another group in central Wisconsin. But it's starting to creep out in those directions too. It's a long way. I don't want to start any kind of a panic here. But the reality is, it's still there. It's not gone away. There's a higher percentage of the deer affected, and there's a bigger percentage of the state impacted. Yeah. And the trend seems to suggest that all those things will continue. So. Yeah. It's a very scary thing, Larry, and I, you know, I know a lot of people are thinking about it as far as the professional, the managers and wildlife researchers and whatnot. But at least at this point, the public pressure, the political will to do something, whatever that magical something might be,
pretty weak.
Still pretty weak.
Virginia in Janesville wanted to weigh in on this a bit. Virginia, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I just want to say that, you know, you're all hunters and you all think the same way, and the way you think is killing. And we have game farms in this state that import and export deers from other places in the United States with CWD. And you just don't want to close those farms down.
Well, in reality, that Wisconsin was, I think, had more deer farms than any other state when CWD broke, and this really put the crimp on that industry in many ways. It's still very active, but it's very tightly regulated in terms of movement of deer around the landscape for the recognition of the exact point that Virginia just made. So the deer farming industry, completely separate from wild deer management, unless and until there's some problem, as we had in central Wisconsin at Buckhorn, I think it was, where there were escapes, and that was a pocket of infection and other such problems. But those seem to be taken care of. What we're concerned about primarily now is the wild herd. And I'm not sure where the killing comes in. Yes, deer are harvested in a big way in this state, and that's still an important management tool, and it's still very important to the heritage here in Wisconsin. So I don't see that as a huge problem, except that the disease eventually threatens that heritage. So that's the issue.
Yeah. Thanks, Virginia, for calling. Appreciate it. We have, and, you know, we'll probably talk about this off and on and through the show, but John's got another topic to raise Let's go to John in Tigerton. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Scott and Larry.
Hi.
Hello, John.
Yeah, I live in Western Shawnee County on a logging road. 12 years ago, I quit mowing and raking. You got to be a bit lazy to do this, but it helped. Anyway, since then, I got all kinds of wildflowers. I got blackberries and strawberries, and it's unbelievable what all the stuff comes out if you let it alone. And I got 4 picks for naturalists, conservationalists, not necessary in this order. And here goes: John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, Teddy Roosevelt, and Scott Craven.
Ah! Well, you're in good.
Well, I've never been mentioned in that company before, but that's pretty cool to think that way. But well, thank you very much.
I think I put you in some pretty good company, Scott.
I think you did.
I think you did too.
I appreciate talking to you people.
John, thanks so much. That's a nice.
Well, that's
comment.
That's very nice. And I mean, John's fundamental premise that if you plant succession is a very powerful force, and it really can't be stopped. And whether it's your front yard, a roadside, an abandoned field, or whatever else, if you let things go, mm-hmm. certain things will happen. And eventually there's something that will be restored there over many years, some type of forest generally in most of Wisconsin. But in the meantime, the kinds of things that he mentioned in terms of blackberry bushes and strawberries and early successional kind of stuff mm-hmm. all comes in. And there are different wildlife species associated with each of those stages of plant succession. So it's a fun exercise to watch. It doesn't mean that we're promoting everybody in every suburb of Madison or Milwaukee, whatever, to pitch their lawnmower and let their lawn go, because in many cases there are ordinances or
right.
neighborhood regulations that simply can't be done. But in rural areas where you have the opportunity to essentially abdicate maintenance on a piece of open ground and sit back and watch what happens, it's kind of an interesting experiment in natural history.
Absolutely. Gene in Almond, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I don't have a question, but more of a comment about the unwillingness of the leadership of the DNR to address CWD. I live fairly close to the 2 new positives in Portage County in the southern part of the county,
mm-hmm.
and deer hunters in that part of the county are forming what's called a Citizens Advisory Committee, and we are working with DNR staff to address the CWD problem.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, we're going to be doing some sampling right now. We're going to be killing some deer to get some additional samples in the core area right near where the 2 positives were.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are going to mount an educational program to get people to test the deer that they do shoot in the upcoming bull and firearm season. And I just like to say that there's a lot of concerned people, professionals in the DNR, that are working as best they can to address this problem. And doing nothing is absolutely the worst thing we can do.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. And for that area where there are a couple of new discoveries, and hopefully it's still a very low incidence, to the extent that you can implement whatever practices and procedures the professionals recommend, you know, do it. Urge your committee
absolutely.
To recommend it. Do the education and do it, because I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I'm, because of where I am active and hunt and so forth, that we were the farm was only 6 miles from the discovery point in 2002, and as indicated, we've killed enough positives among the deer taken that the deer hunting tradition on that particular farm simply evaporated. The deer camp we had, which was fantastic, a great social event, disappeared within 2 years. And it's starting to slowly rebuild through family interest on the farm, but a different group of people. And even that interest is being blunted by the fact that, you know, we said earlier, the odds for us that any deer we take is potentially positive, it really puts a damper on the enthusiasm. So do what you can, Gene. I wish you well, and I hope you can beat it.
Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Coming up today at 2, Kathleen Dunn talks with artist and activist Rodessa Jones. She directs an award-winning performance workshop committed to incarcerated women's personal and social transformation, and that's at 2. Right now, wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, our guest, to talk about the world of our Wisconsin wildlife. Certainly, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Three sets of photos Judith actually put up with her. What do we got there? These are tracks in the snow, and it's kind of fun to take a look at those tracks and see if we can figure out what they are. Scott, what do we got there in that middle set?
It looks like about a size 9 loafer on one track, and the roundish ones with no claw marks and all look like it could be a cat. There's not a great deal to go on the basis of size there, but very direct, straight line, roundish tracks without claw marks. A cat, if they're a little larger and you see claw marks, a fox register about the same way.
Can't tell. We have three sets here. That one we
can't tell at that distance what we've got there. But, in an urban area, there are only so many possibilities, and sometimes it's process of elimination that allows you to pick away at the at the ones that are fairly obvious, like a raccoon track or a possum track that shows their thumb in the track and that kind of thing. So the first one we saw, I think, looked like a cat, and I can't tell from those.
We had a Facebook comment from Nina. Just saw the first robin of the season. About 10 congregated in the neighbor's locust tree. They don't look very happy. Also, the male cardinals are singing their love songs. And yeah, I've heard some male cardinals. That's kind of fun. On the weekend, I was out. Usually, I'm out with my morning walk pretty early. On the weekend, though, it's a little later usually. Sort of at dawn and a little after dawn, the birds are really singing.
Well, it's about time.
Yeah,
it's been just a brutal winter period. I had one robin and a flock of waxwings a week or so ago when it hit 39 for that one day out of the last 200 seemingly, and again they didn't look very happy, and I haven't seen them since, so I don't know what happened to them.
We've talked, I think, pretty much every month about during winter here about this hard winter. And are we seeing, and you have said the impact, the real impacts are probably going to show up later, as you get toward right the end. But are we seeing an impact on deer and turkey populations? I would think in the north in particular.
The north has just been brutal. And from what I hear talking to friends up there, I haven't been able to get up there for a couple of reasons. And I understand our place in Price County is buried, so I'm not sure when we'll get up there. That, coupled with the fact that there's so much snow in the woods and the ice is so thick and there's so much snow and slush on the ice, the ice fishermen aren't getting out to the extent they normally would, and people aren't out in the woods, so they're not seeing things to report. But the people who are telling me that they see a deer standing in the driveway or whatnot, they're looking a little ratty and they're very much disinclined to get off the driveway and back into that snow. So I think reports are coming in now to the DNR folks that suggest we're right on the cusp of losing some turkeys and some deer. How many? We probably won't know until things begin to melt away and people are out and a little more out and about. But the so-called winter severity index was getting bad a month ago and certainly hasn't improved. So it's got to be in some areas getting up to the severe level when at that point the rule of thumb is 20 or 30% of the deer herd could be lost. And turkeys have got to be stressed even more. So, you know, bad for both of those animals, but those happen to be very visible. All is deep, fluffy snow for, even though we're on the downswing in the grouse cycle, deep, fluffy snow is great for the grouse. I mean, they've probably been doing just fine. So it's a, excuse me, it's a mixed blessing depending on the species. There were reports starting to come in that some early birds coming back, some of the diving ducks and whatnot, have come back and where there'd normally be open water on the Great Lakes or some other system. I mean, for crying out loud, Niagara Falls was mostly frozen the other day.
Amazing.
So they're coming back and finding no place to go and setting down in open fields or on slick ice where they have, obviously, there's nothing there for them. And in some cases, if it's a loon, for example, even have trouble getting airborne again. So there are all sorts of things going on. And in addition to the snow and ice, we've got frost penetration that where the snow has not insulated the ground, as you know, with all the problems with water pipes and all. These are areas where, of course, there's been no snow insulating the roads or driveways or whatnot, and we're getting frozen pipes. But if the frost is anything close to that in wild areas, then that's going to be a problem for hibernating amphibians and other things that rely on getting down below the frost line. So it's been a, as all the humans will attest, let alone the wildlife, it's been a tough winter, and it doesn't show much sign of letting go anytime soon.
Peter in Appleton has a question. Peter, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I was just going to say, you guys there?
Yeah,
we're here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I'm kind of in a natural medicine, and I'm thinking, you know, like people, there are viruses and bacteria that are, they've always been around, but there are food sources and, you know, factors like fresh air and sunshine and nutrition that can help a person or an animal that is infected with a virus not have that virus become active and cause disease. And I guess, has anybody ever thought of trying to, you know, get the deer feeding them something that works like a, you know, I don't know, a shot? I mean,
I understand what you're getting at. And actually, that at one point, there was some discussion of, is there some way to inoculate deer? But I think that was set aside because it just the difficulty of doing it was so
over the years there's been talk about attempting to administer, say, an oral contraceptive in urban deer herds where they're worried about alternatives to where hunting is not possible to reduce herds, but deer are a problem in urban areas. Hey, maybe we could feed them something that would render them sterile or whatnot, but the problem is getting the right deer to eat the food, controlling the dose, and a whole host of other things. It's very, very difficult. And then, of course, it leads to the bigger question, what about feeding deer in general, let alone with medicated feed? And that, of course, even in these hard times that we're talking about, the recommendation is still, you know, cease and desist. Yes, some deer are going to be lost, but a frantic attempt to feed probably not the answer.
Thanks, Peter. Steve in Black River Falls, hello to you.
Hi. I have a question relating to the eating of deer with CWD. You know, it seems that, the chronic wasting disease. I'm sure that people have eaten these deer. I understand the disease is out west, too, in places, and of course, before we knew about it here, people were eating these deer, and it doesn't seem to be any link to any human problem. So I just thought I'd like to hear you address that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. There is no evidence to suggest that CWD or any of the other forms of these spongiform encephalopathies have been transmitted to people from eating venison. But the problem is there's that slight bit of uncertainty that leads groups like the World Health Organization or the CDC to simply make the blanket recommendation that you should not humans are not recommended to consume known CWD-infected venison. Now, that's more than enough advice for some people to say, oh, no way. On the other hand, based on the number of deer being brought in for testing, which has declined over time, we know very well that, as you suggest, there are people in the area where there's a high prevalence rate who are likely eating CWD-infected venison and either don't know, don't care, or both. Similarly, it's become, I think, well accepted that there was some level of infection prior to the discovery in 2002.
Sure.
And that people had probably eaten infected deer back then before we even knew the disease was an issue. As I think back on it, a pretty nice buck that my son shot the year before discovery was bizarre in its when we recovered it. I tried to lift it up by an antler. The antlers popped off. The tail fell off when we skinned it. I said, wow, that deer is really skinny. There's no fat on it at all. And, you know, not knowing any better at the yeah. time, you dismiss that as, oh, it's an old buck in the rut, and he's been working hard, and he's just yeah. skinny. Well, you know, thinking back on that and knowing what I know about the disease now, I'm in that area. I'd bet at least a couple of beers with Larry that deer was probably infected, and we, not knowing any better, took it home, processed it, and ate it like any other deer. Ate the whole thing, and so far, here 14 years later, no one in the family has suffered any negative impact. So you're right. Except for that marginal little bit of doubt, there's no evidence that it's a problem. But go ahead.
To me, it relates a little bit to the mad cow disease in Europe.
Yes.
You know, there had to be hundreds of thousands of people over there that ate that infected beef. And for the most part, you know, there's very little relation if you... from what I understand, of getting that mad cow disease, unless you maybe ate the brains or something like that.
That's correct. But, you know, all people who ate beef did not come down with mad cow disease. But the issue there was that people were assured, like they were with CWD, well, you can't get mad cow yeah. disease, but that didn't prove to be the case. Slightly different situation, but nevertheless, I feel pretty comfortable that there isn't a human health risk here, personally.
Yeah.
So I fall back on, okay, but there is a considerable issue as far as the health and well-being of the deer herd and everything that deer herd supports in Wisconsin in terms of the hunting heritage and just the fact that it's a popular animal. So this, it's two separate but related issues, but you're right on all of the counts you made as far as consuming the venison.
Thanks, Steve, for calling. Robin in Portage, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
In my backyard, I live right in the community of Portage, but I've lived where I live for like 35 years. The deer moved in, I can't tell you how many years ago, probably 10 years after I moved in, and they just kept increasing. Now, within the last 2 years, I only have 5 deer.
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago, I counted at one time right in my backyard 17 deer. Oh. Now, all I have is 2 females, and one female has 2 fawns, the other one has 1 fawn, but they are from 2 years ago. So is there a decrease also in the herds in Wisconsin? We have had no sharpshooters come in of late in the city of Portage. We did probably 15 years ago.
Okay.
Well, there's really no way to say, Robin. I mean, deer herds, whether it's locally like your backyard or in a community or even in a deer management unit, go up and down over time with the harvest strategies, the number of permits issued, the weather conditions, a whole host of other things. So there's really no way to say, and there's no way to attribute it. If you were thinking, oh, is the disease having an impact here? That's probably not the case. It's more likely that whole area that you're a part of has seen a reduction in deer numbers over time based on hunting pressure. Now, not too far from you, up the Wisconsin River a bit, I run a managed hunt for a state property up a little closer to the Dells, and over the same period you describe, you know, we've gone from an island that when we started that hunt probably had 75 to 85 deer on a 200-acre island down to the point where, You know, we're talking about 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 deer on the same island. And we can look back at the hunting results from this managed program, and we haven't harvested anywhere near enough deer to explain that decline. So it's more what's going on in a larger area. In addition, even though they're in your backyard at least some of the time, they may move, those individual does may move 2, 3, 4, 5 miles out of town to give birth, or have a fawn or whatnot. As an example, we had a deer on Picnic Point right here on campus in downtown Madison, and this was a number of years ago, and one of our professors was kind of following it around. I actually got a radio transmitter on it, and that doe would spend the winter on Picnic Point feeding and doing what deer do in the winter, and then come spring when it was time to drop her fawn, usually under cover of darkness, left Picnic Point, marched right through the entire west side of Madison and out through Middleton and whatnot, and ended up giving birth to her fawn and using her summer range out in Pine Bluff, which is, you know, six or 7 or 8 miles to the west, and then she'd come back again during the winter. So there's lots going on, but if you were concerned about deer proliferation and the numbers are now down, then count your blessings. If you were hoping to get a definitive answer on where those other deer have gone, that's not going to happen.
No, there we go. Robin, thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Jerry in Menasha a chance. He's been waiting a while. Jerry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I had to switch gears. I have been consistently feeding from my patio over the winter months through all kinds of awful weather, a group of birds and rabbits and squirrels, and I have a bird bath in which I have a heater, so I provided them with water. And what I want to do is cut off feeding them over the summer months, and I want to do it in a proper way. I have to wait until the snow melts. But when do I start withdrawing food? When do I start making it less and less out there so that they will switch and use the grass instead of whatever I'm feeding out there for the rabbits and one thing and another? You know what I'm saying.
I understand what you mean. And the party line is that generally, in fact, I was reading an article in National Wildlife Magazine while I was waiting in a doctor's office yesterday about the merits or lack thereof of summer feeding, and it was kind of a point-counterpoint discussion, and on the one side of the argument, hey, you know, most people figure the animals can take care of themselves in the summer, which is for the most part true, but that there's still some merit in maintaining some level of feeding because, and the author made the argument that, gee, you get to see some of these birds that are not here in the winter but respond to a feeder in the summer, like in my case, my rose-breasted grosbeaks that I really enjoy watching, and they bring their young in, and you get to see all that interaction and so forth. So there's some merit for continuation if you want to think about it, but in terms of the mammals, the rabbits and squirrels, you know, they're fine on their own. Some of the birds you're probably feeding now are going to clear out anyway and head further north, and then some may arrive that you don't have now. And then there are the resident blue jays and cardinals and so forth, which may or may not continue to come to a feeder. If you've made the decision you want to discontinue or at least cut way back, do wait until the weather moderates and there's at least a little bit of green growth. It would seem like, boy, as soon as the snow's gone, well, they're fine. They can find a lot of stuff. But in reality, that's a pretty lean time for those first few weeks after the snow disappears.
Yeah.
A lot of the food resources that are out there have been used up over the course of the winter, and it takes a while for new growth to produce seeds and flower heads and fruits and things like that, and for the insects to get active. So I would, the way this year's going, you know, 2 years ago in March when my fruit trees were blooming, I would have said, hey, you're good to go right now. But the way things are going, I think you're probably still at least a month away and maybe longer as far as starting to cut back.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you so much for calling. We have Tony in Woodruff with a comment. Hi, Tony.
Hi. a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention earlier you had discussed identification of tracks, and there is an organization called the International Society for Professional Trackers. It's the ISPT.org. If you want to look it up on your computer, and it will give you a lot of tips and answer a lot of questions on the types of tracks you see. It's a good organization. I just want to mention that over the air.
Thank you very much. And we should also add to that that occasionally the DNR puts on workshops for soliciting volunteers for their carnivore tracking program, and in some cases just general information type tracking programs at nature centers around the state. And then we've mentioned before that what I think is the there are many books and field guides to tracks, but the nicest one I think is Mammal Tracks and Sign by a fellow named Elbroch, E-L-B-R-O-C-H. We've mentioned that one before.
That's a great book.
It's a great book. So between this association and workshops and self-study either on the internet or by book, lots of good ways to do it. Having said that, though, realize that identifying mammal tracks is still a bit of art associated with the science. Just reading about it and actually determining what a track is, especially in fluffy snow, is not that simple sometimes.
So it's ISPT.org. ISPT.org. Thanks, Tony.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls, and we'll look at some emails and some Facebook comments as well. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor at the UW-Madison, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, my guest today, taking a look at the world of wildlife, Scott Craven, emeritus wildlife specialist with UW Extension. You can join in with your questions or comments at 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have an email from Roxanne in Peshtigo who said she was so excited to share that she had a visit from a barred owl this past weekend. The owl came by Saturday and Sunday and roosted in a tree just above the bird feeders, watching the squirrels, I'm sure. He's very reclusive, so we only usually get to see glimpses of him, but for him to allow me to walk up to within probably 15 feet to take photos, that was thrilling. Very pretty, kind of mysterious. I thought that owls fly typically at night, so I was very surprised to see him. You know?
Well, cool thing to see. Barred owls are pretty widely distributed, and various owls, about as visible as any, I guess. And, well, other than the big influx of snowy owls this year that's got everybody excited. But if she thinks that owl's around, my suggestion to Roxanne would be go on the internet and listen to a barred owl call. It's one of the easiest ones to imitate. The translation is a who cooks for you. You can replicate that fairly easily with your voice, and barred owls are notorious for talking back to you, so you can find out where they are and establish a conversation and a dialogue with them.
Sounds like a plan. Todd from Delavan says we have several fox sparrows at our feeders all winter long. Most of the time, there's only one at a time, maybe two. The last couple of days, however, they're starting to show up in pairs and small groups. My question is, are they beginning preparations for migration? And when they leave, do they do so in groups or solo? That's a good question. Fox sparrows,
I don't know about the migration end of things. You know, when they're around, I'm not sure some of them are going to migrate at all. So that's one issue. But I think a lot of birds are at this point getting geared up to not only leave when the opportunity presents itself, but are getting geared up for the nesting season once things break up a little bit. So I think once we get some open ground, a lot of stuff's going to happen very quickly.
You're right about that. I think we've got another question here, a comment from Mary, an email. Could you address, Scott, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress proposal to hunt white and albino deer and the proposal to hunt tundra swans statewide?
Okay.
What do you think?
You want to do that now?
Yeah.
You know, this is is one of those things that it comes up periodically. The number of either real or potential game species is really fairly limited when you think about the number of birds and mammals we have on the continent, which is between 11 and 1,200 species, somewhere in that area, and somewhere between 140 and 150 are classified as game species somewhere. And there aren't a whole lot of potential additions. In fact, I don't know of anything that's been added to the list in a general sense in a long time. The manipulation comes by state. You remember the controversy not too many years ago when we added mourning doves to our list here in Wisconsin. And there's been a fairly contentious proposal to think about adding sandhill cranes, which will be a challenge because of some other heritage we have with cranes in this state. The tundra swan issue is one where these birds, too, are hunted in some parts of the country. In fact, a group of folks I know from the East Coast just had their annual swan hunt at Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge down in North Carolina. And I think everybody in the group harvested a swan, which they tell me is quite an experience. They are one big bird. And when you bring one of those down, it's kind of like shooting down an enemy bomber in the Pacific Theater. So they are hunted in some areas and consumed, and it's kind of a trophy bird situation. So I think the thinking is, given the fact that they migrate across Wisconsin in substantial numbers, that perhaps this is yet another opportunity for the state's hunters. Whether that notion of providing more opportunity sells with the general public or not, especially with birds that are kind of charismatic and have other qualities associated with them, remains to be seen. But that's the genesis for the proposal, and the birds could probably sustain the harvest, and they are harvested in other parts of the country. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be approved here in Wisconsin, but the proposal's being floated. As far as the white deer are concerned, it's a case where there's a little bit of difficulty here because the regulations within and out of chronic wasting disease management areas come into play. Is there any reason why white deer, whether they're true albinos or leucistic or whatever else, or piebald, need to be protected or should be protected? That's more of an anthropomorphic debate than it is a scientific one. In cases where there are focal points of these animals, like up around Boulder Junction, for example, where they've been immortalized in books people know they're there and they're a conversation piece, a tourist attraction, and so on, I can see where there are local protective interests. But in terms of biologically, is there any reason for the protection?
No.
So this again becomes more of a social issue than a biological one, and that's the way it'll play out.
Sylvia in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm glad Scott's back and doing well. I hate to burst anybody's bubble about the robins, but they have been here all winter this year, from the middle of the state all the way over to Lake Michigan. And flocks. On other shows, both of you have commented about when you're trapping mice, you end up trapping shrews.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious if anyone would try elevating the traps off the ground, maybe 12 inches. I know mice can jump. And I have a doubtful that shrews, the ones I watch here, are pretty close to the ground and stay there.
Well, the shrews certainly, and we're talking primarily about, well, for listeners who may not be familiar with the discussion, you're right. We talk about removing problem white-footed mice or deer mice or whatever from your garage, barn, shed, kitchen, or whatever. House mice are kind of a separate issue because they may be indoors and may be indoors all year. So trapping mice in someone's garage means putting out there are lots of different types of mouse traps, but let's just assume we're talking about the standard old wooden base snap type mouse trap baited with a little peanut butter on the trigger. Put these around in the garage, usually on the floor, and you will catch the mice, but the collateral damage is the capture of an animal that's about mouse size but has a short tail and a pointed snout and is dark charcoal gray. and that's a short-tailed shrew. And the attraction for the shrews to be in the garage is the mice. The shrews will eat the mice, so the shrews, to a certain degree, are on our side. Yet they're caught incidentally in the mouse traps, which is a little unfortunate, but it's the way it happens. So the suggestion here is that perhaps by getting the mouse traps up onto something where the shrews are not as acrobatic or as, they're certainly agile, but they're not as good a climber. And you're right, I guess I've only seen them as I get a fleeting glimpse in the garage or whatnot at ground zero, whereas there are mice on top of the refrigerator I have in the garage and up on all the shelves. They're everywhere. So maybe that's a reasonable idea. I hadn't thought about it, but hey, this is how we advance our knowledge of control techniques. It would be worth a try to get those mouse traps up onto areas where the shrews might not be traveling.
Yeah, good idea.
It's worth a try. It's a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have, appreciate your call. And Michael in Richland Center, I think, up next. So let's go to Michael. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I got a couple of questions. Since I've been living in Wisconsin all my life, and I've hunted for probably 40 years, and although my hunting in the last 15 has really dwindled off, and I've been watching things. I mean, I've done enough with working with farming and that, too, and watching the wildlife and seeing the downfall of grouse, the downfall of the nightingale or the whippoorwill, whatever you want to call it, and a few other species. And one of them, the questions I have, is dealing with the ticks. And because our predators have gone way up, and I've been seeing some that have the predator species, if you will, whether mange or whatever, have issues and problems. And, you know, ticks get on any animal, and then it goes transfers to the deer and humans and et cetera. And the other question I have is dealing with, because I've seen this from the 80s on, about the time when GMO corn, GMO soybeans, and all that had come in, and since that, I've been noticing, I believe, what's happening, and if a study should be done on this, is the fact that it's wearing down the immune system of the animals, humans, etc., and causing a lot more problems. Thanks.
All right, thanks for calling.
Well, I'm not sure how to respond to that, Larry. The tick issue is a little separate from the notion of genetically modified crops. And, of course, there are concerns over pharmaceuticals in the system and the water and whatnot. There are all sorts of things that have documented impacts on wildlife and, for that matter, on people. So there's concern over that. But, you know, I think Mike would agree that society tends to drive these things forward to increase crop production because we don't know how else to dispose of some things. There are a lot of reasons why these problems occur. I don't necessarily think that they're the root cause of the changes that he described that he's seen over 40 years. He mentioned the decline in grouse. Now, in southwestern Wisconsin, Scott Walter's work at UW-Richland Center is pretty well documented what happened with habitat change over time, and then the grouse simply was no longer a suitable environment for them. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have anything to do with genetically modified crops or other such issues. In the case of the decline in whippoorwills, again, habitat change as well as problems in the tropics where they're, or in South America where they're wintering. So there are lots of explanations for observed population changes over time, and there's lots of concern over some of these trends that Mike pointed out. And, you know, I don't know what to say. People know they're out there, but it often takes some sort of a calamity to move people forward on some of these issues. And so far that hasn't been the case.
Thanks again, Mike, for calling. And Joan in Michicot, thank you for calling. Hi. Appreciate your call.
Hi. thank you for taking my call. Yesterday, I had a red-bellied woodpecker on my tree, and with binoculars, his back looked like down. He did have some feathers, but there was this soft, fuzzy stuff kind of peeking through the feathers. Was this a young woodpecker, or...
Wouldn't have been a young from this year, for sure.
It shouldn't be a young one. I don't know. My favorite birds at our feeder now are a couple of red bellies that are coming. Yeah. They're just beautiful birds, and they're pretty regular visitors when you get them coming to a feeding station. That back is usually pretty sleek, and the black and white checkerboard pattern is one of the things that makes them easy to identify. All I can think of is some type of mechanical damage that either a squabble with another woodpecker or something else, or something grabbed it in its roosting cavity, or some, you know, potentially ice or freezing issue. Something mechanically damaged those feathers, and what you're seeing is either the feathers growing, which they will do, growing back in, or the down that was underneath them simply exposed, and hopefully they grow back in and the bird's fine, but probably not a young one.
Probably not a young one. Thanks a lot, Joan, for calling. I appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. He's emeritus professor in the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Scott. Stay with us. We will be right back. We have many great regular guests. They come by to spend time with us, with all of us, sharing what they know. And probably there aren't very many that have as much a following as Scott Craven. And he's with us today to talk about the world of wildlife. He comes by once a month, the first Wednesday of the month. And Scott, always great to have you spending time with us. Thanks for coming by.
You're more than welcome.
We're having a great time today. I got a Facebook comment from Daniel Scott, who says, Scott, I've always appreciated and admired your patience with the respect you exercise when handling discussions about hunting. We all could benefit from practicing your diplomacy. I think the tradition means something a little different to each person. The one constant is that hunters have done more, probably spent more money and dedicated more of their time to preserving wildlife than any other group or organization, or probably all of them combined. For most hunters, the interaction with an observing nature is the ultimate prize. So.
Well, that's a great comment, and I would just emphasize that it's true. I think a lot of people who don't hunt perhaps assume that, well, you know, our abundant wildlife and the diversity of wildlife we have and all is all, well, it's just there, and it always has been. And in reality, a lot of these species were dramatically depleted 100 years ago, and it was hunting groups and conservation groups that worked hard to bring those species back and develop things like the wildlife refuge system and assorted other issues which benefit all species. So it's not entirely laid at their doorstep, but hunters have played an important role in conservation over time.
Bob in Madison, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for having me. I have another rabbit question.
Yeah.
First, you're talking about catching mice and mouse traps, and I would just like to say that put them in a corner rather than right out against a wall, because the mice will walk into them the wrong way sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I have one where I caught a tail, and then the mouse took off, so I just wanted to mention that. But as far as rabbits go, I'm on the west side of Madison, and we have a couple rabbits in our yard, and I'm just wondering, what do they do in the winter, and should I be putting out some kind of a shelter for them, because I feel sorry for them?
Yeah, no, of all the animals, the rabbits are pretty capable of finding shelter under a deck or under some construction material or just under a bush, and they get by pretty well as far as the winter is concerned. I don't think you need to worry about creating shelter as far as they're concerned.
Okay. Yeah.
And, but I did want to say something just before I forget. Your comment on trap placement, if you're trapping mice, whether it's in the house or garage or anywhere else, there are some pretty straightforward rules relating to trap placement to take advantage of the fact that mice have a and rats and rodents in general have a keen sense of touch. It's actually a long term that, but in other words, if a mouse has a choice, it's not going to run right across the middle of the garage floor. It's going to go down one wall, get to a corner, turn, go down the other wall, and so on. So you take advantage of that, as Bob suggested, in the trap placement. Mm-hmm. Placement along the wall is fine, but you don't put the trap parallel to the wall. You put the trap perpendicular to the wall, mm-hmm. with the trigger end against the wall or close to the wall,
yeah.
and the bail away from it. And in some cases, then you'll catch the mice as they're trucking down the wall, whether there's any bait in the trap or not.
Yeah.
So, yes, in you kind of have to think like a mouse and learn a little bit about their biology and ecology and movement patterns, and then you can place your traps appropriately.
Thanks, Bob. Brian in Pensauke, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for my call. I was hoping you guys could explain brainworm in deer, which I'm hearing a lot of in our area here, and if there's any contaminated meat concerns with that.
Okay.
And also, from time to time, I'll get a bull kill where we'll have to give it some time, and in that time, the coyotes will get to it. And I was wondering, like when I go to cut that deer up, I'll usually leave a 6 to 8 inch buffer from where the
coyotes
stop and where I start cutting and keeping that meat.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any concern with contamination with that meat there too?
Well, I can't say much about the brainworm situation, Brian, so I just hadn't heard anything about that as being a current amidst all the things the deer herd is dealing with right now. I hadn't heard anything about brainworm, but I'll ask about that. The state chapter of the Wildlife Society's annual meeting is next week, and all the wildlife folks from around the state will be there. I'll ask around and see what I can find out and report back through Larry. The brainworm often, in fact, about the only context that I hear much about it is the fact that it's in deer. And it's one of those things that where deer are abundant, it's one of the reasons attributed to the fact that moose, which are struggling to get back into northern Wisconsin, are generally negatively impacted by deer. It's not necessarily a problem in the deer, but it is in the moose, and they can contract it from the deer. But anyway, we'll check up on that a little bit and report back. As far as finding a deer that may have been a bow kill and you don't find it till the next morning, the coyotes or something else did a little gnawing on it. I think that comes down to common sense, and it sounds to me like if you're allowing a 6-inch buffer from anything that's been damaged and the hide is otherwise intact, then the rest of the meat, you know, assuming temperature or other kinds of contamination haven't been an issue, should be just fine. That becomes a matter of, I think, personal preference and squeamishness as much as anything else, much like consuming deer that could potentially be CWD positive. Different people have different levels of tolerance for it. And if you're comfortable with cutting around an area that's been chewed on, I guess I've had that happen to me twice. Once was my dog that got into the garage, and once was a cat that got into the garage but wasn't my cat. And my response was similar to yours. I gave a generous area to cut away from the damaged tissue and then went ahead with processing. So I don't see any reason why that should be a problem in any way.
All right. Thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I had a friend who had that happen in Saskatchewan while he was bow hunting, and a trophy buck, but the wolves got it overnight, and they
probably not much left to process.
There was nothing left to process, as a matter of fact. Joy in Montello, hi, thank you for calling, Joy.
Hi, I'd like to know why we can't feed the deer. There are so many pretty deer in the backyard, but someone has told me we can't feed the deer in Marquette County.
There are a couple of considerations. One is just a general notion that feeding deer is problematic for a lot of reasons, but in areas, and I think Marquette is probably one of them, if you're in an area where a CWD-positive deer has been discovered or an adjoining county, then there's a complete ban on feeding to prevent spread of chronic wasting disease. So I think that's probably the primary issue as far as you're concerned.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
so
because I saw in Green Lake County you can, but if you're in a Marquette County you can't.
And that is because of the distribution of positives for chronic wasting disease. And if you want to check into that, you can go to the DNR website, and there's a link to their CWD section, and there'll be a map in there as to where they've found positives and which counties. And it's a patchwork around the state, depending on where positives have been discovered.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that's why you may be one county adjoining another one. You can feed and bait. The other one you can't, and that's uh-huh. because of the disease.
Yep, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Ray on Stevens Point, hi to you.
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges facing the reintroduction of moose. I understand from an article I read that moose have some parasites that are causing their populations to decline across all their territory across the country.
Minnesota
is losing what was a very large and healthy moose population, and there's been a moose population problems on Isle Royal and some of the iconic areas around the country that were known for moose and the opportunity to see moose or hunt moose or whatever with moose. They're simply disappearing. And at least from what I understand from the Minnesota people, and this has been featured in the national news media yeah. over the last few weeks, they simply don't know.
No.
And there's major research projects underway to try and figure out what in the heck is affecting these moose and whether it will prove to be parasites, disease. I don't think it's predators because they've gotten along with their predators for quite some time. Hunting pressure has been all but eliminated as a factor. No. I don't know what time will tell, but there's a lot of people curious about it, anxious about it, and they're working on it. That's yeah. about all I can tell you.
And we have a few in the state, I believe.
Yeah, there's a handful, most of which have trickled over from the UP, which has been right. a bit more successful and aggressive in terms of an actual reintroduction. As we mentioned with one of the previous callers, where you have high deer densities, generally moose don't necessarily flourish, but we may not have very high deer densities in the North Woods over the next couple of years, Larry.
Yeah.
The way the winter's been going.
My Bayfield County deer population may have taken a big hit this year. That's where our cabin is.
The bottom line, Ray, is that, yes, there are some dramatic moose population declines near us, and they're trying to figure out what the heck is going on and reverse that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You could join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Well, you know what? Spring is going to get here.
I hope so.
And there's things we can do, you know, to kind of look forward to spring.
There are a few things we can and should do as far as wildlife is concerned, and one of those is to – it's kind of tough to get out right now. I'd like to get out and clean my bluebird boxes out, but – It's not pleasant walking around on the property
right
now.
So right now,
it's as soon as things moderate a little bit, get those birdhouses cleaned out, repaired, and put back in place. Or if you're trapped inside, go out in the shop or the garage and make a few new ones or get some new ones. So be ready with your birdhouses. We talked earlier about the merits of continuing bird feeding on into the summer if people so choose. People are thinking about their garden plans. I've already got all my seeds, although they're just sitting in a box in the closet. And, you know, think about as you plan your gardens and landscape plans, think about shrubs and trees and so forth that ultimately will have some food or cover value for wildlife. But also think about as you plan your gardens, trying to avoid some of the problems that people will undoubtedly have with ground squirrels, rabbits, deer, and so forth, and make a fence part of your plan and that kind of thing. And then I guess the last caution here is when the snow finally melts, and as you say, it will, Larry, I think.
Yep.
I hope it does.
It will.
You're gonna see some things that you may not want to see, all these little trails and runways cut through your lawn. That's the work of meadow voles, and that's only cosmetic. But the meadow voles may have also gotten to some of your landscape shrubbery or dwarf fruit trees or whatnot and girdled those beneath the protective blanket of snow that we've had, which was probably good for the voles. And if you lose some trees, that's just good fodder for being ready to go next winter to protect these with hardware cloth or other defensive strategies so that doesn't happen again. But certainly be ready here on a lot of counts as spring breaks as far as helping or avoiding problems with wildlife.
And we have Dick in Oak Creek with a question. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Real quickly, we had a raccoon under our camper. And what happened was I had someone come in and go in there because he'd chewed up the ductwork. And I came in last summer, about August, and he came crawling out of there saying there was a raccoon under there. Well, about a month later, we get another company coming in, and they basically found the raccoon, or what was left of it. And I'm curious, there was not much left of it. And I'm curious, how long does it take for a raccoon to decompose?
Time of the year.
not this time of year, they won't decompose it. Yeah. It's probably could have been sitting there for 4 months untouched. But under normal weather conditions and warm weather, again, a raccoon can be pretty sizable, rotund animal. So assuming a normal adult raccoon, maybe a 20-pound animal, if it were simply left intact, it's going to be a period of weeks before you're left with little other than dried skin, bones, and fur. If, on the other hand, it dies and then it's scavenged or torn apart by an opossum or shrews or other things that might take advantage of the free meal, that would greatly accelerate the decomposition, as would warmer or humid weather. So the quickest you'd see something disappear, probably a matter of several weeks and longer, especially if there's cold weather involved. It could be months and months. So that's kind of the range.
Yeah, there you go, Dick. And Mary in Dodge County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is my husband walked through as he was hearing the comment about feeding deer, and he said the research has shown that it doesn't do any good to feed them because they can't digest hay and corn, and it's showing that they're dying with a full stomach. And so their stomach bacteria is designed to digest twigs and the drier grasses.
True. They're ruminants, and their gut fauna, so to speak, is not necessarily tuned into alfalfa pellets or corn or whatnot, but they can certainly adapt to it and realize that one of the primary food items for deer in southern Wisconsin is waste corn. So they can digest it. The problem is that on a steady diet of corn on a feeder, their gut fauna gets changed around a little bit, and if the corn's cut off, then the difficulty is going back to the twigs and browse that they normally eat. So you're correct in principle that their digestion is compromised one way or the other by the feeding, in addition to a whole host of other problems. Yeah. That all leads to the conclusion that it's not in the best interests of a frantic feeding program.
That is true. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. We have, we've got some great photos on my Facebook page. I hope you can go to the Facebook page. There's a nice shot of a red belly.
That's a dandy.
Yeah, a nice close-up from Ed in Genoa County. Great. And then Ed's got another deer. That looks like a bear track next to a footprint or next to a foot.
Yep.
And then that person also sent us a photo of a pack of wolves.
Yep.
2, 4, 5 of them just down the road from where they live. And then Joanne sent...
What's that, a bunch of turkeys? I can't
turkeys
see it from
eating
here.
Yep. Berries in the tree. There's a tree. Yeah, it's kind of a sideways picture, but see if I can get that bigger. Wow. Well, plenty of turkeys there.
Plenty of turkeys and hopefully something for them to eat because it's been tough on the turkeys.
Yeah, it's been tough. So lots of good photos up on my Facebook page. So I hope you'll go take a look at. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you will find it.
Just on the topic of turkeys, Larry, just wanted to remind folks, any would-be turkey hunters out there with the spring season not too far away in April. Leftover turkey permits, in other words, the ones that weren't distributed through the drawing process, go on sale a week from Monday on March 17th. And that runs a series of each day there's a different zone up for sale. So it starts with Zone 1 on Monday the 17th, goes to Zone 2 on Tuesday the 18th, and ends on Friday the 21st with Zones 5, 6, and 7, which are northern Wisconsin. And then on Saturday, all that are left from all the zones go up for grabs in a general way. So if you did not get a turkey permit back during the December or January draw, you still have a chance to either get one so you can go, or you can buy more if you already have one. You could buy them at the rate of one a day. And I think they're $10 for residents and $15 for non-residents, and there are close to 100,000 left. So,
wow, a lot of them out there.
Don't forget, if you want to hunt turkeys, there's still an opportunity to get permits.
The May 14th, that period this year. It's actually my third choice.
I think that's fourth period.
Fourth period, yeah. It was my third choice.
And most of the permits, by the way, are for the latter periods in May. None of the units have permits available for either period A or B, which are in April.
Yeah, I know. But I'm going to take my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, out, and we'll have a good time.
You will.
We definitely will. David in Brookfield. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, a question regarding purple martins. Live in Brookfield and around a lot of wetlands and have tried for several years to attract martins, but with no luck. Are they not in the area anymore?
Well, they're in the area, and they're highly sought after. The tricks of the trade are, you know, first of all, to have a good martin house, a colony box. There's all sorts of designs, and they can be pretty elaborate, pretty expensive, or pretty complicated to build. But assuming you have a good box and you have a good mounting system for it, and you've got the fact that you're near water, which is often an attraction, particularly along a lake shore, and in an open area, so you put your martin box out and you kind of pay your money and take your chances. There are only so many martins to go around. There are a lot of people after them, and of course the martins are pretty tenacious in terms of the colony boxes that they've been using for years in terms of returning to them. And there have been some issues with martin populations in general, particularly in the wintering grounds and so on. So I don't know what to tell you. You've had a couple of years of no luck. I would say be persistent and hopeful. And if you've done things right, we're all pulling for you. We're hoping that you'll get martins, but there's no guarantee.
There you go. Thanks, David. We had an email from Marie, by the way, who wondered if coyotes live or travel alone, or do they generally have a pack?
They're usually in groups called packs, and there can be quite a few of them in a pack, but at least as they make a periodic passage across my property in southern Dane County, there's usually a group of them. That's not to say you won't see a solitary coyote, too, but generally they're in groups.
And just feeding a Facebook comment from Mindy, who feeds the Madison Mix wild bird food in her feeders and usually puts out a little basket for the squirrels and rabbits. She has 5 to 6 turkey coming in and at least 3 to 5 deer in the wee hours of the morning, and it also makes a comment about deer and corn digestion issues. She wonders, she says there are broken bits of corn in her bird food. Should she stick to strictly sunflower seeds instead? And I would say no, I wouldn't have to do that.
Well, you know, a lot of people feed straight black oil sunflower. Yeah. That's kind of dominated the bird seed market for quite a few years, and that's fine. Most birds will use that, but you can use some specialty seeds like safflower for your cardinals or Niger for your finches. But there's nothing wrong with a mix that's got some cracked corn in it. I think the Madison Audubon mix is a third cracked corn, a third white millet, and a third sunflower.
Very good.
Keeps everybody happy.
Scott, thank you so much. We'll see you the first Wednesday of, oh my goodness, April.
April.
Things will be a lot better then.
I hope so.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. He'll be back on the first Wednesday of April when things are going to be warmer. I'm convinced. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.